This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Also, the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 62, Inside the BSI Weekend.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burt Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Aha! Hello again, and welcome back to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Walder.
Excellent. And the dynamic duo once again reunites to bring you the crime-fighting forces of the audio waves of wherever you're driving, walking in place, listening, sitting, sleeping, mm-hmm. or otherwise consuming this fine podcast.
That's right. We stamp out evil even when we're not stamping or stomping.
Well, we stamp something out. Yeah. And how have you been stamping out things in the last month since we've chatted?
I've been stomping and stamping. I've actually been trying to make a dent in my reading pile, which only got bigger after the BSI weekend and a trip to the dealer's room on that January weekend, where, among other things, we'll have to talk about this sometime.
Yeah.
I left, obviously, with a copy of Irregular Stain and a bunch of other things that I'm now looking at. I have one shelf in my study here at home is full of unread books. And the last time I counted how many unread things I have, the number was over 40, and it's just embarrassing, so I'm trying to make a dent in that. But, you know, I get distracted. I don't know what your reading habits are, but sometimes I'll read, you know, 30, 40, 60, 70 pages or something, get distracted, and then come back to it a year later. I'm not disciplined.
I feel your pain. I read 30, 40, 60, 70 words and get distracted and I look over at Twitter, and then I look out the window, and it's squirrel, and then back to the page, and then flipping to the back, are the pretty pictures, and yeah. Now that's the thing with our little hobby here, is there are so many books, so many things to consume, and now, of course, we certainly have the electronic media as well that are constantly flowing. It seems like there is no end in sight for Sherlockian content. So, you know, I think the challenge and the opportunity for collectors and Sherlockians today is to be content with the content, you know, and as a collector, I've realized that myself. I can't be a John Bennett Shaw in terms of collecting. And for those of you who didn't know John Bennett Shaw, he was a giant of a Sherlockian, literally and figuratively. He was magnanimous. He was as generous with his time as he was with his resources. And this is a guy who had all of the collecting sensibility of a vacuum cleaner. And in the words of an old friend of mine, he was not a collector. He was an accumulator. Mm. And he was a completist. And his collection really became part of the basis of the Sherlock Holmes collections at the University of Minnesota Libraries. And, you know, the world that we live in today with this renaissance of Sherlock Holmes that's going on in all forms, it's impossible, literally impossible, to have one of everything. So the collectors today, I think, do well by fine-tuning and honing exactly what it is that they're interested in, and they focus on that. So, you know, I think for me, that means I'm buying fewer books just to say I have them. You know, I want to make sure I have the essentials of a good collection, and there's a particular area that I'm focusing on, but that leaves far fewer unread books on my shelves than it previously did.
What do you focus on?
I'm kind of hesitant to give it away because I don't want other collectors to beat me to it. Oh. But I collect first edition Burt Wolders.
Oh, well. I'm the only one, so you're doomed.
Well, we'll get to this later in listener comments. But there was a piece that you wrote about 40 years ago or so.
Oh my goodness, that's right.
Came back. We'll get to that, and we'll make sure we don't forget about that. But yep. what I've decided to focus on collecting is BSI materials. So obviously, any of the original publications by the irregulars, not only the current ones, but you know, going back to the originals, things by Edgar Smith. H.W. Bell, you know, some of the early irregulars. So Smith certainly is part of that, and other early irregular leaders and official and unofficial publications by, you know, the Pamphlet House, the BSI Press, etc. Mm-hmm. So all kind of in and around that era from the late 30s through the early 60s as part of like the vintage collecting. And then again, you know, once we came up to speed in the late 80s through the current series with the BSI publications.
I like that. I mean, there's a lot of satisfaction around that. See, yeah. I am not a collector, but because I'm older than you, my acquaintanceship with Holmes and the world in which my interest in Holmes solidified was a world characterized by the hunt for things. In other words, if I wanted to read The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes by Vincent Starrett, I had to go to an old bookshop because it wasn't in print when I was in high school. Or maybe it was and I just didn't. No, it wasn't. It wasn't still in print. But things like that, you know, and I would read about Holmes and I would read about these tantalizing books. I would come across names like Gavin Brand, and I would discover people. You know, I was lucky enough to actually know Michael Harrison, but Michael's stuff was not in print. I remember one of my biggest successes, you know, when I was in, I don't quite remember how old I was, but Basil Rathbone had written a book called In and Out of Character. And it wasn't a very popular book, and there weren't very many copies printed. But I really, really wanted a copy of In and Out of Character, and I remember finding it, and I still have it. So my collecting, such as it was formed by wanting to read things and having to go to old bookshops, which I like to do anyway. But other than that, I was not really a collector. I mean, I wasn't someone who was pursuing first editions. I was getting things to read. And if I read them and really loved them, I hung on to them. And if they weren't so hot, I gave them away or sold them.
Collecting things to read, that's quite odd.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what it is. Any kind of collecting effort, and I know we're getting a little bit off tangent here because this isn't a show about collecting, although we have had shows like that before. We think back to episodes 16 with Jerry Margolin and 17 with Otto Penzler. A couple of great interviews there about the real itch behind the collector. I think the important part is whatever you collect, you should enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You know, and collectors are not are not made. They're born. Mm. You know, you kind of have that bug. I mean, I know you also collect pens as well, right, Bert?
Yeah, I do. I did. I don't still buy them, but you know, it's funny what you consider yourself to be. You know, I have I never considered myself to be a pen collector, but when I set out all my pens and look at the pens that I've bought over the years, you must come to the conclusion that you're a pen collector, because I've had, you know, dozens of pens. So therefore, you know, either
that or you're insane.
Or both.
You'll be at the New Jersey home for the recently bewildered, right?
Permanently bewildered, yeah.
Oh, bewildered, it all works. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you didn't necessarily consciously go do that, but it was a passion, and you followed your passion, and lo and behold, look where it led. So,
I always liked fountain pens. You know, and then I would discover a different company, and then I would learn more about the company. Parker's. My father gave me a Parker that he'd received when he was a young boy, and then I discovered the Parker Duofolds of the 1920s, and now I got a lot of pens.
And there was an ad that I found sometime in the...
Oh, the Conan Doyle ad?
Yes, in the late 80s, early 90s maybe, that Conan Doyle had endorsed.
Molesworth, right. Dear Lord Molesworth, your number 7 broad is what I have needed all my life. Arthur Conan Doyle. Yeah.
What, do you have that framed on your wall or what?
I wish I did. I had a copy of it, and I probably still do have it somewhere. But, you know, it's one of those things that's very hard to find, that ad. I can't find it even on the internet. It was a 2-page spread.
Yes.
With a handwritten letter by Conan Doyle endorsing the Parker Duofold, of course. And he died in 1930. And so the pen that he would have been talking about was probably 1926, 27, 28, available in the UK. And, you know, I have some Parkers of that vintage. So.
Well, I'm just checking the Fountain Pen Network, and they said, Parker Duofold from the year 1921. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote stories of Sherlock Holmes with this type of pen.
That's interesting language. This type of pen. I think if I remember, there's some connection between the hound and that particular pen. But pens and writers are curious things. You know, Rudyard Kipling used to send to his publisher all the time. I think it was Kipling. These imploring notes to have more pens sent to him. He sort of went through them. And Morley himself was curious, had curious habits about pens. I think he had fountain pens, but he never filled them. He always dipped them, I think, into inkwells.
Hmm. So. Very old-fashioned. Well, what do you say we dip ourselves into some of the goings-on from January? You know, when we came off of the BSI weekend in the early part of January, our priority was to turn around an interview that we did during the weekend fairly quickly and promote that. And that, of course, was episode 61, Vincent Sterrett, where we talked with Ray Betzner and Susan Rice there at the Players Club. And we've gotten some wonderful comments on that that episode. I think a lot of people enjoyed it. But, you know, we wanted to get that out of the way first. And now that we're into the month of, that was our February show, wasn't it?
That was.
I'm getting ahead of myself. So that was recorded in January for release in February. Now we're in March looking to wrap up the BSI weekend and give you a little bit of a sense as to what it was like there. And I know... You know, first of all, this year, the weather was fine. Usually, and you think about all the weather that the East Coast has been socked with, certainly ever since. We're lucky that we got in and out as easily as we did, because usually the BSI weekend is fraught with inclement weather, and those collars turned up and those deer stalkers shoved down. You know, we didn't have to go through that this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were lucky.
I know. So, you know, it lasted from Thursday through Sunday, really, with the core of activities happening from Thursday night through Saturday afternoon. And I'm not going to go through the whole schedule here. Of course, if you'd like to have a sense as to what the BSI Weekend is all about, head over to BSIweekend.com. Or coming up in the spring issue of the BSI Weekend, of the Baker Street Journal, which is one of our sponsors, by the way, you can actually read a recap of various events and the weekend as a whole and get a sense as to what it was like. But I think what we'd like to do, because you can read about what the BSI Weekend is all about by going online or certainly subscribing to the Baker Street Journal. What we'd like to do is to bring you some of the sounds of the BSI Weekend as well.
Yes, we would. And actually, we're starting with a sound that we've had in our library for about a year, but it really is worth listening to. We hope you think so. The oldest irregular that is still with us is a wonderful man named Art Levine, who was... Oh, I don't have my... Do I have my notes here? Oh, yes, I do. He attended the BSI dinner this year, but he also attended last year, and last year was his 60th Baker Street Irregulars dinner in 2013. 1953 was his first dinner. He was invested in 1955, and this is the Edgar Smith era, as the cutter Alicia. And before the dinner started, I had an opportunity to sit down with Art for a few minutes just to talk about his memory. The first question I asked him really was how he came to know that there was such a thing as the Baker Street Irregulars in the first place.
And when I was in high school, I wrote to Christopher Morley, because I read in the Cleveland Public Library, they had two books in an open shelf. One was The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, the other was Morley. It wasn't Morley, it was Ellery Queen's Adventures, yeah. And I wrote to Morley, because he was mentioned in one of those books. He wrote back and said that, I should contact Edgar W. Smith. So I did, and he put me in touch with the Science Society at Akron, which is called the Scandalous Bohemians, Clifton R. Andrew. And I called him, or I wrote him, and he invited me to his meetings, a couple of meetings. That was a few years back. Picked me up, took me there. When I wrote to Morley, I think I was about 15. When I wrote to Morley originally, and then I wrote to Smith. And this is years apart. Then I got a hold of Andrew, and Andrew took me to two or three meetings in Akron. And then he offered me to pick me up and drive me to New York for the dinner, which he did twice. Must have been 53 and 54. Long drive, because they didn't have the turnpike then. They had only roads. So that was a long drive, yeah. No, it was 12 hours. Oh, yeah. 500 miles from Cleveland to New York. We went to the dinner, and I met Edgar Smith. I met at the head table, there was Rex Stout, Fletcher Pratt, Basil Davenport.
Right.
There were about five, and of course, Edgar Smith, who ran the meeting. And then there were a whole bunch of people. There were, I think, they limited the membership to 60 at that time, the number of the stories. So I remember a lot of the people. I have some pictures, of course. But they had papers, they had drinks, disputations, you know, the same thing that they have here, except wasn't as elaborate. Well, I was at that time Let's see. This is my 60th dinner. I was 23 when I came here, and I was invested 2 years later when I was 25. I think they were in Cavanaugh's for several years before they moved someplace else. I don't remember. But Cavanaugh's was the first few years. The Cavanaugh's a long time.
Well, I mean, you're talking about a connection back to the Giants, legends.
Yeah.
Rex Stout, Christopher Morley, Edgar.
Yeah, it's amazing, wow. Isn't it, that his reminiscence begins with writing to Morley?
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Morley would not live many more years. He died, if my memory is right, in 1957.
Four years
after... that note from Art Levine.
But what a sweet guy, you know. I in typical Midwestern fashion. So how did you arrive at the BSI? I drove.
Right. Oh dear.
Well, I mean, that's nice that we've got that connection to history, and quite frankly, I know that. I think Francine Kitts. Well, Francine, of course, does the obituary. She reads the lives in total of the irregulars who have passed on. But she has assisted under Andy Solberg and now Marsha Pollack with the BSI Oral History Series, mm-hmm. where we sit down with people like Art and I'm trying to get through all of the irregulars just to learn more about what life was like. Back then, how they came to Sherlock Holmes, what they did, what the dinners were like, where they stayed, things like that. So kudos to you for picking up on that opportunity with Art and having that chat.
Oh, thank you. Well, that gets us from 2013 to 2014. And we did have an opportunity at the dinner this year to capture some very excited people. A few moments after they were invested to really capture that experience. And we began with S.J. Rosen, who had this to say.
I can't believe it. I'm going to Disney World. No.
We invariably get one of those every year. You're the
I bet
first.
You do. Yeah. Oh, good, 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 good. No, I'm thrilled. I was completely... absolutely didn't expect it, except when he got to Chinese American Detective, I thought, oh my God, that's me. I didn't expect it. I don't deserve it, but I'm not giving it back. I'm going to frame it as soon as I get home.
So explain the connection for those of our listeners who aren't familiar.
Oh, the Chinese thing.
Yes.
I'm invested as the Imperial Palace at Peking. Before I was a writer, I was an architect, thus the palace. And my series character is a Chinese-American private eye, thus Peking. So it was really kind of brilliant.
It was
the right investiture.
As Mike was reading off not only the name but the description, were you putting any of this together?
When he got to the Chinese-American detective, I thought, oh, my God.
Who else is there in the audience, right?
I mean, unless there's somebody. So I knew it was me, but then I thought, now, do I get up now? Do I wait till he's done? If I get up now, I'll be like, you know... It's kind of presumptuous, but if I don't get up now, it'll take me forever to get to the, By the time I finished thinking all that, he was done. So, I was thinking, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall.
So, easy enough. So what's next for you?
I'm going home tomorrow and go back to work on my new book.
And where's home for you?
Here.
New York. Right here in New York?
Yeah, okay. Downtown.
And so. Your new book is what?
It's called Skin of the Wolf. And it is not a Lydia Chin book. It's a paranormal thriller that has to do with vampires, shapeshifting, and the Native American culture of the Northeast.
Wow.
And
it
will be out in August, not under my name, but under the name of Sam Cabot, like the cheese.
We've got it here. You heard it here first, folks.
You did.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it sounds like quite a book.
It does. It does indeed. And then next, we strolled right over to...
Chris Music.
Oh, to Chris Music, my...
With a very appropriate investiture for someone named Chris music. He was invested as Wagner Knight at Covent Garden.
Indeed. And he is a fellow amateur mendicant from here in Detroit. So very proud of him for that. Let's hear Chris's reaction.
It's like being in a dream. I can't believe it. It's unbelievable. What's the first thing you're going to do? I'm going to tell my wife and tell my kids, and we'll have a good time. Have a drink, too.
Well, as one amateur mendicant to another, congratulations.
Yeah, next stop is the bar. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, he knew what he was going to do. That's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Wagner Night at Covent Garden. Very musical.
Very great. And it's nice to see in the other investor shoes. You know, one of the things that Wiggins has done now over the years is brought back some of the great old investiture titles. And Sonia Featherston was invested in January as the Solitary Cyclist. And she, and let's hear, and this is her reaction.
I've got investments. you know, the Solitary Cyclist makes me think of Helene Juhasova. It's a powerful connection for me. I'll have a lot to live up to.
So where do you hail from?
Oregon.
From Oregon with Jerry.
Oh, Jerry's a New Yorker.
Well, have you got your Howard
not anymore.
Style down here?
Yes, indeed, sir. Leslie Klinger here on the field.
How does it feel to have been assassinated?
What are you going to...
Congratulations. Oh, so well deserved.
Oh, thank you.
It was one of those, they said to Betsy, isn't
she
a regular?
Exactly.
I know.
We were cut off.
That's right. Cut off at our...
Well, you know, I mean, that's one of those sentiments that Les just mentioned at the end there, that, you know, someone who you have long associated with and for whom you've had great respect, and they finally get their investiture and you say, wait a minute, weren't you already invested into the BSI? So it's always gratifying to see someone like that raised into the ranks. And, you know, Sonia's been at this for a long time. Of course, she did the 2012 BSI Christmas annual, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, has had a long interest in Sherlockian scholarship, been a regular contributor to the BSJ. So great to hear her name being called.
Yeah. And next on our list is Mark Alberstadt, who hails from Halifax, which is now his investiture.
The investor name was Halifax, which is the city I'm from. I was surprised. I was happy. And when Mike started reading the investiture and he called it Halifax, I was sure hoping it was me.
Yeah, who else is it going to be, right?
Well, it could be a cruel joke. But no, thankfully it was me. And I got up and it wasn't someone else's name called.
So what's next for you in the world of Sherlockiana?
Well, we're always running the club in Halifax. It's I started over 32 years ago, and so we have our dinner tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
And so Sherlockian to Sherlockian, and then always working on the next issue of Canadian Homes.
Excellent.
We're hoping to get it more of an online publication, have a subscription rate for just online, and then a subscription rate for printed.
Excellent.
So something a little new in the electronic Sherlockian world, so that'll be exciting.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to covering it, and all eyes will be on Canadian Homes.
Well, thank you. Hopefully we'll get lots of contributors, and we're always listening to you as well.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, how about that? An electronic edition plan for the Canadian Homes. I hope our sponsors are listening. I mean, this is the direction that the world is going in, whether you subscribe to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. You know, any of the other main publications, there are digital versions of those publications. And a lot of times they're bundled in with the print.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, even a discount given if you are a print subscriber to the digital version. So, you know, the world's changing. And Sherlockian content, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, is everywhere.
You know, I was thinking about that earlier when we were talking about books and collecting, and wouldn't it be wonderful if there was, I'm sure we'll see it eventually, but wouldn't it be wonderful if there was the ultimate Sherlock Holmes collection, you know, Bennett Shaw, 2.0 available online, where you could get every text, access it on any device, read anything you wanted, have it all at your fingertips. I mean, I would still keep, you know, so many of the books that I'm fond of, but wouldn't it be wonderful if everything was available with just a click?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's not going to be too far off. And I know through the University of Minnesota collection, you can search the John Bennett Shaw collection and actually see what the bibliography is. There are a listing of all the assets. I know the Sherlock Holmes, the BSI archives, they're working on digitizing those as well, making those available to collectors. It's something that's happening, you know, and Google Books, Google Books has pushed in that area too.
What's becoming more apparent as the technology races along is the technology has the potential to thrill just as much as acquiring a book, a rare book, a long-sought text, a long-sought first edition has an opportunity to thrill. And I thought about that the other day when we saw some traffic on the internet. I think it was about the Harry Ransom Center, where they were making available, or perhaps they had been available but had not been widely accessed, fabulous scans of some original Sidney Pagets. You could see how much was lost in the translation to print. I mean, here's the original drawing.
Right.
And the contrast, the highlights. You know, he'd gone over it with some sort of flake white or some gouache or something in these two or three particular illustrations. And it was absolutely thrilling to be able to see his work in such detail online. And that's something you would never see unless you were one of the relatively few people who were lucky enough to actually own an original Paget.
Right, right.
But there we are. So moving on, another great investiture given out in January was Lucky Jacqueline Morris's The Lion's Mane.
OMG.
OMG. Spoken like a child of the internet. Well, what are you going to tell everybody?
Thank you to everyone. I don't know. I can't even think.
Well,
I'm in shock.
Congratulations. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Float on air.
Heaven, isn't it?
Regina, tell us how proud you are of your friend.
I am so proud of Jacqueline. I cannot even express it in words.
It's been a long time coming.
This is our little slice of heaven every year, and I just love it.
And it became even more heavenly just now, didn't it?
It did, yes, indeed.
That's good.
Yes.
Well, we're all happy for it. Clearly, the crowd reaction when the Lion's Mane was announced as Jacqueline Morris, it was the room erupted.
It did. It definitely did.
That's what we like to hear.
No, it's nice to hear excited people.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
And so the last investiture, the other investiture that we had that evening, we didn't get, sadly, we missed getting some detailed thoughts from Peter McIntyre, who was invested as Arthur Cadogan West. But we did talk to our friend Terry Hunt, who, as he pointed out to us, has now finally made something of himself.
I am elated. I first read about the BSI in 1968.
Whoa!
In the New York Times, there was an article about Julian Wolff going on the first Reichenbach expedition, and I actually wrote to him. And I said, I know you just don't join the BSI, but I asked if there were any groups for young Sherlockians, and he wrote back and got me hooked up. And I remember thinking back then in high school, my gosh, is there anything I could possibly do to become part of this stellar membership? And I obviously was able to fool somebody. And here I am.
What, 45
years? And I can't wait to tell my mom, because I always promised her I would make something of myself, and now I literally have.
as the Something Hunt.
And where do you hail from?
We live in Catskill, New York.
Okay.
Now, I moved up from Long Island a few years ago.
Okay.
And when I was on Long Island, I was a museum curator for Nassau County Parks. And one of the sites I supervised was Christopher Morley's studio, The Knothole.
Yes.
So that helped to get me into the loop. I always had an interest in Sherlock, but that helped me to get in and meet great people like yourselves and start writing. And I am just thrilled. Just thrilled to be part of the membership.
Well done. Well deserved. And congratulations to you, Terry.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's great. The Something Hunt.
Something Hunt, yeah.
He is something.
He is something.
And I love that connection to Christopher Morley.
Yeah. It's great. And were you part of one of those trips to go out and see the Knothole over the years?
I wasn't part of that one. I did get on the bus and head up to East Haddam to see Gillette Castle, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the Knothole. Well, we'll have to go out to the Knothole. It's although I think it's not open all the time, but I've been out there, and it's a lovely thing for those of us who are fond of Morley. It's a lovely thing to see the place where he worked in his later years.
Yeah. Well, you have your own podcasting cottage, right, or shed that you go to? Right?
My podcasting shed. Yes.
That's the thing, you know, okay, I can understand back in the day writers saying they've got a little writing shack or a writing shed, you know, whether it's a full-blown cottage or just a single-room hut. I know Neil Gaiman, for example, he still does that, and he's shown some pictures of his. You can get yourself out of the house and into some, you know, a solitary setting where you're not distracted. I would have a hard time seeing anyone doing that just for podcasting, though.
Yeah,
or for tweeting.
Me too. But that's it. You know, if you really want to write, getting out, getting away from distractions. I mean, my writing desk is pretty bare. You know, you just really need to be focused on what you're doing. And there have been some lovely books over the years, Writers at Work. And every so often, I think the New York Times Magazine within the last couple of weeks had a short series of photographs, including Joyce Carol Oates, her studio, and others. It's always interesting to see where writers work.
Indeed.
Conan Doyle could write anywhere, was at least what was reported of him. You know, he could...
Yeah, he wrote on the train. He wrote during cricket matches.
Sure.
I don't know.
Well, and that, speaking of writing, that gets us to really the last audio clip that we have from the weekend, which was with Randall Stock, and you will shortly hear Bob Katz, as the Two Shilling Award was bestowed upon Randall. And that's what, and it sounded something like this.
Totally shocked, very surprised, and glad that I was able to make it here this year.
Well, we're glad you're here, too. So tell us, what's the extra shilling for?
An extra drink, I think, at the next...
I'm Bob Katz. I'm the co-editor of now two volumes of the BSI manuscript series. And in both of those volumes, Randall has been the key... Randall and Phil Burgum, we have to give Phil credit. But certainly Randall has been the key contributor. This is a totally deserved Two Shilling Award. Randall has been the mainstay of the BSI manuscript series. We might as well not do the series if it wasn't for Randall.
Exactly.
Andy Salberg and I, who was the co-editor with me, were talking just in the cocktail hour today that after the dinner we were going to talk to Mike and say Randall should get some kind of recognition for the years
the
of service, for
the,
some award
exactly.
for doing all this terrific work with the manuscript series. Well, we don't have to talk to him now because you just got the big enchilada.
Thank God. It's
great. Randall has done a superb job of a very difficult technical task, and
he's a quiet hero.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, this is the background that goes on. Right? No, you're laughing, but we're serious.
Exactly,
we're serious.
Right. Look, and Andy and I got Eddies last year. We got Eddies this year. Randall made us look good.
This is like part of the infrastructure that supports the entire process.
It's
right?
a great team, and everybody plays a part. But Randall's like the, what do you call it, the capstone of the whole thing, and I'm so happy that he got this recognition. Let me shake your hand. As your co-editor, I'm absolutely delighted.
You heard it here first, folks. Congratulations, Randall. And I guess we'll be talking to you later in the year to talk about what goes into actually making all this possible.
Yeah, I think we will. Enjoy it. Thanks a lot.
Two shillings with a testimonial. That's awesome.
About that.
That was great. Bob is on the scene. So, you know, in addition, I should mention this too. In addition to having that testimonial from Bob, we're actually going to hear from Bob and Andy in a show not too long from now to talk about the book that Bob mentioned that they edited. Another notch in their belts for the BSI manuscript series. So expect to hear more about that. But just if we can pause for a moment, I know we've taken you through some minutes of audio clips from people that are really excited about an event that some of you may never have either heard of or may never even go to, and that's okay. I think what we're trying to do here is to just share the emotion and in some cases, and you heard through those clips, the friendships that have formed. And the genuine excitement that people have, not just around getting together around this character, but in getting together with each other. And, you know, we've mentioned it time and again in this show. This really is about friendships. And as much as, you know, you and I, Bert, have a friendship that goes back decades now. It pains me to say that in a way. in a good way, but... But we've continued to develop our relationship through these little calls, through these little recordings that we do, even though we may only get to see each other once or twice a year.
Hmm. Well, you know, and it's a good coda, too, or a good echo, actually, it's probably the better word, to our discussion last time with Susan and Ray about Vincent Starrett. The lovely thing about the community is you can be part of the community without ever schlepping to New York and going to the dinner. Starrett himself only made it to one. And it certainly didn't lessen his impact. He was, as Susan and Ray observed, something of a god.
Well, why don't we turn now to our community of sponsors? You like these segues, I know.
Very smooth.
And we have a few other items to get to after the sponsorship that'll keep you raptly entertained. But one of our sponsors, of course, is our friends at Wessex Press.
Oh, the Wessex Press.
Yes, everybody's favorite kind of press. And lots of great new titles out from the Wessex Press. I know last time we talked a little bit about some of their audio offerings, certainly that Starrett Speaks CD. Available for $12.95, but of course you've got those two new books that hopefully we'll be having a review on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere at some point soon. One is a scholarly set of works, One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, A New Generation on Sherlock Holmes, edited by a number of the Baker Street Babes with an introduction from Laurie King. Interestingly, as I was thumbing through this, I've just browsed over a couple of the essays so far. I looked at the authors. This is an all-female tome. Huh. So I thought it was really great that not only are the babes bringing in new blood, a new generation commenting and writing about Sherlock Holmes, but they're bringing in females hand over fist. So I won't object. No.
Girls involved in Sherlockian doings? Good grief.
That's funny. When I was talking to, who was it? I think it was John Besh. When the first time John and I met was at the Speckled Band dinner in 1992, I think, 91 or 92? 91. It was 91. And... Of course, this is one of the few stag societies that's left. John gave a line that he lifted out of Casablanca Why did you come to the Speckled Band dinner? Well, I came to meet girls. Well, there are no girls at the Speckled Band dinner. Oh, I was misinformed.
I was misinformed, yes.
So anyway, that's one of the offerings at West Express, along with Anne Margaret Lewis's The Watson Chronicles, a novel, Sherlock Holmes novel, written in story format, multiple stories, from our good friend John Watson, with the very steady hand of Anne Lewis guiding everything. So get over there, check out West Express, tons of great stuff there. Tell them that you heard about them from I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. I don't know if they'll give you a discount or free shipping or maybe just a hearty and hail thank you, but please let them know that you heard about them thanks to us.
Right, and after you're done there, please type on over BakerStreetJournal.com. It continues to be the leading Sherlockian publication since it was founded by Edgar Smith back in 1946. And there are recent publications that are associated with the Baker Street Journal. First of all, if you're listening to this, you really should subscribe to the Baker Street Journal. There's no reason not to. The Christmas annual is absolutely fabulous and a real delight every year. And you don't want to miss that. And the only way you can get that is if you're a subscriber. But you can pick up some of the recent publications, including Irregular Stain, which is the second stain in the BSI manuscript series, and also The Remarkable Characters of Arthur Conan Doyle, a survey of Conan Doyle's
leading Remarkable figures, Characters,
Remarkable
right?
Characters, edited by Joel Silver. And there you are. Not to be missed, the Baker Street Journal, BakerStreetJournal.com.
And then also for you, our dear listeners of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, our friends at Audible are offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial. That's free. And that'll give you the opportunity to kick the tires a little bit, check out what Audible.com offers, and to browse around. So just looking over the Audible site here, you know, I know we've mentioned some of the Mary Russell books that Laurie King has written, but interestingly enough, here's a radio program, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, narrated by, although it's not narrated by, he stars in it, Sir John Gielgud, and also Orson Welles, who made an appearance there as Professor Moriarty, which we'll talk about that more in just a little bit. There are... of course, The Improbable Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, with contributions from our friend and fellow irregular Neil Gaiman, Anthony Burgess, Laurie R. King again, and of course, the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes Unabridged, as read by Peter Batchelor, Sherlock Holmes in America, John Lellenberg, who's been on the show before, and Martin L. Greenberg and Dan Stassauer. So over 460 results right now on Audible when you search for Sherlock Holmes. So lots of great stuff there to check out. Just get on over there to audibletrial.com/Sherlock. That's audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Boy, these drummers really like to do their thing, don't they?
Well, they're very percussive, yes.
You get a guy on timpani and that's all.
That's all. But the news is always good, and we depend on you for news. To contact us, please call us, 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. We'd love to, if you leave us a comment, we'd love to use it on the show. Email us, comment at ihearofsherlock.com. And find I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, ihearofsherlock.tumblr.com, twitter.com/ihearofsherlock, facebook.com/ihearofsherlock, and leave us a review on iTunes, please. We would love your comments.
And also, if you are on the website, Take a look at the sidebar there, or if you're on mobile, keep scrolling down. We have a couple of things there from around the web. The I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere Flipboard magazine, as well as the Sherlock Everywhere Scoop It. Now, these are both kind of news and story curating systems where we just kind of pull things together that maybe we don't have time to write a full blog post for, or maybe it doesn't warrant a depth of discussion, but it is content that we would like to share with you. And we think that in our aptitude as hearing of Sherlock Everywhere, it's our job to help disseminate and distribute some of that information to you as well. So if you're interested in getting involved in the site at all, either as an audio or as a writing contributor, go on over to the Who We Are section on the nav bar on ihearofsherlock.com, and you'll see a listing of who our contributors are, but you'll also see a link there for contribute. And there's a handy-dandy form there if you would like to submit your name and you feel that you have something to say, something to add, we can certainly do that. We have stables of writers who do book reviews. We have some who have specialty beats, say, around comics or gaming or children and Sherlock Holmes, etc. So feel free to take a look there and see if there's anything that really matches your interests. And if you feel like becoming part of the I Hear of Sherlock family, we would be delighted to have you. Because really, this works an awful lot like Holmes and the Irregulars. Bert and I are only two people, and we really don't have the power to go everywhere, overhear everyone, and see everything. But if we have our fans, our listeners, our readers participate and to act as those eyes and ears, it certainly helps. So feel free to take a look.
Yes. And speaking of those eyes and ears, we actually have a little more drumbeat. We actually have listener comments that we would love to share. Information from our listeners, including a very interesting and appropriate message from, of all people, Lamont Cranston.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Wonderful email address, Lamont Cranston at hushmail.com. And I find my mind being clouded even as I think of the name. Lamont Cranston, that fire opal ring he carries on his fingers confused me even more than usually. He writes, I discovered your webcast and podcast a few months ago. I enjoy them very much. I can tell you really enjoy this work. I first discovered Sherlock Holmes back in the mid-1970s when I was in the sixth grade. A local TV station ran the Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce films every Sunday afternoon, and I was hooked. I'm certainly not anywhere near your level of expertise. Well, I don't know about that, but I'm more than a casual fan. And your podcast is helping me renew my interest in the stories. And he goes on. Now, this, under the pen name here of Lamont Cranston, this is Colin Kingston of Walnut, California. And he goes on to say that I'm reading an interesting book about Orson Welles and his work in old-time radio entitled The Medium and the Magician, by Dr. Paul Heyer. And the book mentions a couple of Sherlock Holmes tidbits. Welles did a radio adaptation of Sherlock Holmes about 7 or 8 years earlier than his Mercury Theater production of 1938 when he was still in his teens. It was for a local radio station owned by the Todd School that Welles was attending, and it could have been Welles' first radio broadcast. And Welles had seen William Gillette perform the play Sherlock Holmes when Welles was a child and based his own Mercury Theater Company version on it. And then he goes on to mention Harry Allen Towers, a producer for the BBC in 1952, who worked with Wells on the radio programs, The Adventures of Harry Lime and the Black Museum. And according to Heyer, Towers offered him the lead in a Sherlock Holmes series, but he was busy with Othello, so instead he decided to do Moriarty in The Final Problem. And Holmes appears to have been both Orson Welles' first radio broadcast and his last. And Colin goes on to ask, do you know if this makes Welles the only actor to have played both Holmes and Moriarty in two different productions?
Hmm. Well, as fate would have it, we consulted with none other than the Oracle of Sherlockiana, Peter Blau. And there is another inference of, or instance of, Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty being played by the same actor. Not in the same production, of course, but Anthony Higgins played Holmes on stage in 1983 in a production called The White Glove. And then he took up the role of Moriarty and Wraith, as you may recall, from Young Sherlock Holmes in 1985. So a couple of portrayals are not too far apart, really, of the same actor playing Holmes and Moriarty.
Very good.
So there you go. We also have a note from, let's hope I don't butcher this, Jose Goas Hull, Santiago de Compostela, Spain. Says, first, as usual, my warmest congratulations for the great program you give us. Today, after reading Paul Herbert's The Sincerest Form of Flattery, I only have one question. As a fervent, obsessed pastiche seeker, where can I find a copy of the story titled Notes from Baker Street, written more than 40 years ago by a certain Bert Wolder? Yeah. Thanks and keep things going.
Yeah, that's a question. Well, Jose was, it's amazing. We got that email, and I vaguely remember that, and I had no idea it was ever noted in a book. But in those days, Andy Page and I and others, I think Andy Peck too, were involved in a scion that had just gotten started under Steve Clarkson's auspices, and we published it, like every right-thinking scion. We published a newsletter, and I think that story, Notes from Baker Street, which was about the real inside scoop around the giant rat of Sumatra, which, as Jose pointed out, involved Holmes himself being the bait in a giant rat trap, was something I think that I had written for that journal. So I'm sure there's a copy somewhere in my basement, because everything is in my basement. In fact, Judge Crater and Amelia Earhart are actually in my basement playing cards right now.
Can you check to see if my keys are down there? Because
they are.
I misplaced those.
And your socks.
That should be the first place I look.
That's right. But I'll have to find that. But it's wonderful to have that reminiscence. And around the same time, or a little afterwards, I remember putting out my own newsletter, which I think had three or four or five editions, which was just a gag newsletter, but I had a lovely title for it. It was called Lady Frances Carfax's Disappearing Newsletter. So when, of course, it stopped publishing, it was
perfect.
Perfect. Yeah.
True to your word as a publisher. I like that.
Yeah, no one expected.
Oh, that's great. Well, we also have an email from Simon Palmore from York, England, saying, I was very pleased to discover your podcast recently. It is a great listen. Like many, I discovered the Holmes stories when I was a young child of 10 or 11. My interest lay dormant, stirred by movies over the years, until 30 years later when my daughter was born. She loved listening to the BBC radio adaptations of the whole canon, starring, of course, Clive Merrison and Michael Williams. And these have become our benchmark for all other Holmes adaptations. She is now 16, and until the Cumberbatch Sherlock, she would not countenance another version. She would say, they're not as good as the real ones, meaning the Marison versions. And then Simon asks, have you ever covered radio versions of Holmes on the podcast? And are these BBC radio ones well thought of in the U.S.? Keep up the good work. Really appreciate it over here. Simon Palmore.
Hmm.
Well, that's an interesting question. We have not covered the radio adaptations, and there are a number of them, too. Whether it's Gielgud, as mentioned earlier in the show, or, of course, Sir Cedric Hardwicke. He did some in, for the BBC, I believe, in the 60s. Of course, the Edith Miser shows from, did those go back to the 30s?
No, they...
or the 50s?
No, they started in the late 40s, I think.
Okay.
Right. I think they were simultaneous or closely tied to the end of the Universal series.
Okay. And then, of course, the Marison series, which I have that entire collection on DVD and or on CD, and I think it's just, one of the greatest full adaptations of the canon. And they're dramatized as they would have to be for the radio. They're not actual full readings of the stories, but the head writer Bert Kuhls is well versed in radio and did a tremendous job with his staff of writers bringing the canon to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about this, and it was wonderful to see Bert at the last Baker Street Irregulars dinner this past January. It was nice.
Yeah.
Great to see him there, and we would like to, I think, to devote a podcast to that. The world of radio is obviously very attractive to folks like us who do podcasts, and we'd love to look back and share some of those clips with you, so maybe we'll figure out a way to do that with Bert.
Yeah, stay tuned, and thanks for the question and comment, Simon.
Excellent.
So who else do we have? Looks like episode 61 garnered us a few comments. A notable one is from Matt Laffey,
who handles the
weekly or biweekly Sherlock compendium links on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. He writes for always1895.net, and we syndicate those links on our site as well. I think it's a great service that Matt does to the Sherlockian community, as I've called him before. He's a digital Peter Blau. But he says, regarding episode 61, which is, of course, The Private Life of Vincent Sterrett, I think I've been looking forward to this podcast my entire life. Or thereabouts. What an incredible treat. Two of my favorite Sherlockians, Susan Rice and Ray Betzner. Hey, wait, Matt. Talking about my all-time favorite Sherlockian, Vincent Sterrett, with Team iHose. Just waiting for an uninterrupted hour and a half to bask in the inevitable glory of iHose episode 61. That's great.
Yeah.
And I think we had... we had Chris Music chime in as well. Great interview with two great guests discussing the greatest Sherlockian ever. Nice work, Scott and Bert. I'm surprised there wasn't another great in there. I thought it would have been great work. Either way. Well, thank you, Chris Music, the aforementioned Chris Music from Wagner Night at the Opera.
Yeah, very good.
So a lot of nice comments there. And quite frankly, the Sherlock Holmes community over on Google+ is thriving. Nearly 1,400 members at this point, and it is really a self-driven model. It's not really an I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere community, but it is something that we put out there. And it is really fan-run. And the content that you'll see there is just tremendous. Lots of visual examples of Sherlock Holmes. We have people like Jack Wilson, who contributes an awful lot of visual elements there. Some commentary, as usual, always insightful by James O'Leary, whether it's to make some points of his own or to pick apart some of the stuff that Brad Kefauver puts up there. And there's a smattering of Cumberbatch material and Brett material and Rathbone material and Elementary. So you'll see if your interest falls somewhere in the world of Sherlock Holmes, it is represented on the Sherlock Holmes community on Google+.
Excellent.
Thank you.
And that can mean only one thing. Someone's getting tired. No, it is the editor's gas lamp time.
Hallelujah.
Whew, thought we'd never make it. And in this case, reached a random arm. No, reached an arm randomly up to the shelf and pulled down the March 1995 edition of the Baker Street Journal, edited by William Cochran. And in this case, it was entirely appropriate, we found. This is something hearkening back to episode 61, and if you have not yet had a chance to listen to that episode, if the previous comments did not actually move you to do so, then this gas lamp perhaps will. And if this gas lamp does not, then there's simply nothing we can do for you. But this ties back in homage and subject to Vincent Sterrett. It's called Re Sterrett, Beatons, and the Unknown Bookman. 1995 is a significant milestone in a world where it is always 1895. This phrase may have been coined by Vincent Sterrett in his immortal sonnet 221b. Sterrett was an author, columnist, and above all, a bookman. Yet from time to time, he was forced to sell his beloved tomes to meet his financial obligations. On one such occasion, a fellow Sherlockian named Logan Clendenning heard of Sterrett's plight and gave Sterrett his collection. I am a firm believer in serendipity. The canon is filled with evidence supporting this stance. For example, the canon owes its existence to the fact that Watson was wounded in the Battle of Maiwand. What if Murray had been elsewhere or otherwise occupied? It's likely that Watson may not have survived. Thus, he could not have returned. He would not have met young Stamford. He would not have yet met Sherlock Holmes. And he could not have accompanied Holmes on one of his greatest cases. But I digress. The wonderful thing about searching through specialty bookshops is that sometimes one discovers something that's gone unnoticed by others. In January 1995, I debated the purchase of the Baker Street Inventory by Edgar Smith. I was uncertain as to whether I had this booklet, but I was certain that it was on the Shaw 100 list of essential books. Finally, after 2 days of conscience searching, I made the purchase. I could scarcely believe my eyes when I reached the hotel. Inside this edition, in pencil, were annotations made by some anonymous bookman. Sterrett sale and a monetary value following 79 of the entries. As to which sale, there were no clues. There were clues concerning the date of the sale. This sale must have taken place after 1946 because inventory has a copyright of 1946. The book also had an entry that the bookman had penciled into the pages near the August Derleth section. Plus stories, 4, appear in Re Sherlock Holmes, Sioux City, Wisconsin, 1945-250. Again, Derleth's book had been published too late to be included in Smith's work, and since it has a copyright of 1945, the sale had to be after the publication of this edition. I'm aware that the standard of living has risen considerably since 1945, yet I could not help but marvel at the prices listed for various items. By today's standards, are well out of range. One entry under the heading The Sacred Writings, A Study in Scarlet in Beaton's Christmas Annual for 1887, Ward, Locke & Company, London, first edition, pictorial paper wrappers, Sterrett sale, $175. It is likely that this was the very copy that Logan Clendenning had given Sterrett in 1941. And then a quote, "The box contained some 20 of the most desirable items in the field, including the desperately rare first printing of A Study in Scarlet. It was the nucleus of a new collection, and touched and overwhelmed by the gift, I began on it at once." And the editorial continues. Having established that Sterrett had received a copy of Sherlockiana's rarest jewel from Clendenning as a gift, it is understandable that someone would be able to acquire that same copy for $175. This had been the cost of my copy of the inventory in January 1995, and the Beatons must be one of the rarest pieces of Sherlockiana in the world. Suffice it to say that it's so rare that the late John Bennett Shaw did not have a copy in his extensive collection. Yet, here, in pencil, it's noted that Sterrett's copy had sold for $175. I had purchased the Baker Street inventory because I was uncertain whether it was in my collection. My desperate need was to fill a gap in the Shaw 100, and when I returned home, I already had a copy of Edgar Smith's book. In fact, a copy inscribed by the editor. Of the many books observed this weekend, the copy with evidence of one of the Sterrett sales was the only book that kept haunting my thoughts. That is serendipity.
That's just lovely and very aligned with our earlier conversation about collecting and books and so on.
Indeed. I love it when a good plan comes together.
Yeah. Well, and, you see, that's why the rehearsal time that we devote to this, you know, it really pays off.
It does. It does indeed. And like I was going Swiss to say, it's just fine-tuned. We don't over-talk each other. Right. We don't have gaps.
It sounds casual, doesn't it? It's really, we're really very, good very, at this. Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you read the pre-prepared script that I've slaved over the last month in preparing, I mean, boy, Bert, I just, you've really got it.
Yeah, really. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm on the wrong page. Wait a minute. That's right, Scott.
Oh, boy. Well, I love it when a plan comes together, and I love it when an episode wraps up.
Me too.
Wait, what? No. This is the sweet sorrow of parting.
Yes, it is.
Where we must come to the fact that you are Bert Wolder.
You're exactly right, and you're Scott Monty, and together
we
say,
choice.
Yeah, you've got no choice.
The game's
afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.